There's a section of the orchestra that isn't always in the same place. Sometimes they're up, sometimes down. Sometimes they sit on stage for a half an hour before they play a single note. But when it's their turn, boy, do you know it. That's right, it's the percussion section. I'm Colleen Phelps, and we'll talk to the Nashville Symphony's principal timpanist, Joshua Hickman, about life in the back of the orchestra, today on Keeping Score. When it comes to noticeable and profound moments for the percussion section and the timpanist in particular, it's tough to beat also Sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss. The piece makes a memorable appearance in Stanley Kubrick's 1968 film 2001 A Space Odyssey. The music, however, is from 1896. It was based on a book by the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, also called Sprach Zarathustra. This wasn't unusual compared to Strauss's other tone poems like Don Quixote and Don Juan, Till Eulenspiegel and Macbeth, but this novel was quite a bit newer. It was only 10 years old when Strauss set that sunrise to music. The piece itself has nothing to do with monkeys or technology, but it does have something to do with the heavens, especially the opening movement titled Dawn. It starts with darkness, notes so low they're almost imperceptible. The brass enters with perfect intervals. They're not major or minor. They're not happy or sad, just fast. And then they're punctuated with timpani. As the Nashville Symphony's timpanist, Joshua Hickman is picking up the 49-year legacy of predecessor Bill Wiggins. It's a role that's prominent in the orchestra, constantly visible and consistently audible, even when he's hidden behind a screen like in this concert. So I asked him about those exciting moments that the timpanist gets to create.
So there's a moment at the beginning of this concert, at the beginning of the Strauss, where everyone in the room is going to wish they were you.
And the screen's going to be down and the lights are going to be off and no one's going to see me do it, but they're going to hear it. But just like anything in music, what you hear is the product. So as much as I'm going to love to be able to play and have everyone see how I'm going to do this, how I sound is what's everyone's going to be hearing. So much rests on making something so simple sound very dramatic and well-placed and with a big sound.
The simplicity of it is really, really brilliant, because I think a lot of people would say, you know, there's just something about that opening, about that musical moment, and there's so little to it.
There is little to it, but then there's what a performer can bring to it makes all the difference. So either you can bring a heavy-handed approach to it that makes the drums sound like any other percussion instrument, or you bring an approach to it that makes the instrument speak something beyond just being a drum. And that's where the difference is. And it's something you, like, I'm having trouble putting into words, but I know it when I hear it, just like anyone else sitting on that stage can hear the difference even if they can't put it into words.
Well, in the piece, you know, to analyze it might be to ruin it, but let's do it anyway. It starts with open, perfect intervals.
It does, because Strauss composed this piece to be a conflict of duality of key areas. So not necessarily major and minor, but the whole idea of there being this key of C, which represents the universe, and the key of B, which represents man. And then the whole Nietzsche relevance bridges that gap by suggesting that there's always going to be a conflict between man and its universe. They're never really going to be able to be in sync, even though they are just a half step apart from each other, represented musically.
It's great that we got to talk about this because the first interview I did this season was with Tucker Biddlecombe about creation and how creation starts with this morphing around the key of C, and how in creation also C represents the let there be light.
That is true.
Ta-da. And now we have a piece where the plot of the book it's based on has God is dead, has the main character going around preaching God is dead, which is a really amazing combination of thoughts for one season in the symphony. It's not the theme of the book, it's the plot.
It's also very interesting to have that combined also with this week's performances with the images of the earth and also achievements by man, space rockets going into outer space, achieving that technology, and then looking at what we understand, basically a perspective of Strauss and viewing everything that we know it, our observable, sensible ability to understand and reason what we know. And that in itself is a good enough answer as opposed to looking at what might be out there and then building a foundation upon that.
Practical question. In a concert with a video like this, are you ever tempted to just turn around and look?
Thankfully, I don't have to because there's a screen projector for the people who are sitting in the chorus loft, so I can see what's going on for everyone else that's in the main audience.
And it was almost like Strauss hedged. Originally, the program note he wrote, first movement, sunrise, man feels the power of God, andante religioso. And then right before the premiere, he changed it to, for too long we've dreamt music, now let us awake. We were night walkers, let us now be day walkers. Do you ever, as a percussionist, and speaking as a percussionist myself, do you ever catch yourself thinking about the vast philosophical sentiments in classical music and then realize you're expressing them by hitting things?
I don't really think of it that way. I when I look at the part and I look at the score and then I listen to how other people have interpreted it, in my mind what I'm trying to figure out is what do I want to bring to that first rehearsal that is how I feel I can interpret this part and still be within this realm that this composer has created in this particular symphony, concerto, overture, whatever it might be. And then to shape that based upon what then I then hear everyone else doing as best as I can. And then of course, with whatever the music director wants. So it's less about that I have to hit something, but it's more about how I'm going to hit something that encompasses my thought process.
You're listening to the Nashville Symphony Percussion Section performing Ogun Badagry by composer Christopher Rouse, another friend of the podcast, during a live performance in May of 2018. It's time for a short break. Thank you.
When you want to listen to classical music but aren't near a radio, 91 Classical is still your source for great performances from Middle Tennessee and around the world. Stream music on our website while you work. Tune in via the Nashville Public Radio app on your smartphone, or tell your smart speaker you'd like to hear 91 Classical.
I'm Colleen Phelps, and welcome back to Keeping Score. The audition circuit for orchestral positions is famously competitive. So I asked Joshua Hickman what it's like to make it through to the other side.
You, I realized, are the first auditioned timpanist for
That's
this orchestra.
True. For 49 seasons, my predecessor officially played, but I believe he'd been here for longer than that.
Since before it was a fully professional orchestra.
Yes.
So for those who don't know, how does one get a job in an orchestra?
You send in your resume and you hope the committee will approve it. And if they do, then you spend pretty much every waking moment for the next 2 months preparing and playing for other people, and then preparing even more and playing for more people, and then recording yourself and listening to yourself, and then finally getting yourself to the audition and playing your absolute best.
Do you remember the numbers for when you auditioned? How many people made it through the resume, and how many people were finalists?
I believe for this orchestra audition, over 60 resumes were approved for preliminary rounds. And they ended up at the very end narrowing it down to myself and one other candidate. And that's usually how it works. There's only been a couple of auditions since I started taking them where the orchestra has announced that all candidates will be considered for a preliminary round audition. That's only happened twice for me, and more than 100 people showed up to those auditions. Some of the bigger orchestras I auditioned for, they would receive, you know, close to 200 or so applications or resumes to be considered for a live audition. And what they will do to give people who aren't, they're not sure about, they'll give them a chance to make a tape or a CD and to send that in for further consideration. And I've had to do that a few times. So I've always felt pretty good that whenever I've made CDs or tapes, they've been acceptable and been able to get me into the auditions. And the big thing to try to learn as quickly as possible is to not let your nerves get the best of you when you're out there and you're by yourself and all you can hear is feet shuffling, papers, and an occasional cough. You know, it's just very much an empty space and it's just you, and it feels like a lot of pressure.
And it's blind. You can't see.
No, that's the idea, is that you can't see the committee. There's a screen in front of them. All that happens is a proctor will walk you out on the stage and announce your number to the committee, who will then proceed to keep track of what they're hearing, what they like, what they don't like. And at the end, they will deliberate on a particular group of candidates and decide if any should be advanced to the next round.
If you don't mind answering, how many of these did you go through?
This, for Nashville Symphony, was my 26th audition. And out of the 26, I have made it to finals or a trial of some sort 13 of those times.
That's really good numbers.
Something was going to work out at some point. They always say that. Go to your teachers whenever you're disappointed by not getting the job or getting eliminated from finals, and they're like, don't worry, you're that close. Something's going to work out at some point.
So things people have always wanted to ask the timpanist. I'm going to give you some of the silly questions that people ask all the time, and things that I know the answer to, but I'm going to let you go ahead and answer them. Why do you put your head down next to the drum during the concert?
That's actually a very good question. I play particularly with calfskin heads. So any change in temperature, humidity, lighting, if someone breathes the wrong way, changes the fluctuation of the pitch of the instrument. So I'm always checking to make sure that when I have in my part that someone is playing a particular passage and it's in this particular key and it's just before I have to play, that my notes are going to resonate sympathetically with theirs so that I know that my pitch is going to sound good with what they're doing.
That's a better answer than I gave at a children's concert once where I told the kids that the drums are scratch and sniff.
Don't do that. It's not pleasant.
Often do you change them out?
For calf heads, as long as none of them break, I usually switch them from the start of the season. I usually switch them out maybe late January, February, going into the second half of the season. I don't want the first set that I use to be particularly worn out before they start to break or come apart. I want to be able to have them as a backup for the backup set. And then if that fails, I have, what I try to do is keep two sets of synthetic heads for all of the orchestra's timpani available so that in that emergency, they are there. If all the calf heads break, I have something that can be used on the instruments.
Should one break during a concert, what would you do?
It has happened to me, and it's
here?
Very, very scary.
Did it happen in Nashville?
Yes.
When?
That's the thing. The important part about it is you don't want anyone else to know. And that's exactly what the guy on the podium that particular week says. He's like, I had no idea you broke a calf head. And he's like, that's the whole idea. Of course, you didn't see me turn ghost white and start sweating for no reason.
It is still, you're hitting a really thin piece of material. And it's not like poking a hole in a box. It goes from an instrument to a thud.
And most people aren't aware of that difference in sound because they're far enough away that they don't really notice that something had broke. But when you're sitting right over the instrument as you're playing it, it's something that you hear immediately, like, what was that? I don't remember hearing that from the drum the last time I played this.
How many different pairs of sticks do you use during a typical performance? What's your average?
I have about six pairs of timpani sticks that are my main go-tos when I start the performance or when I prepare. They work the best with my hands, with how I play, whether it's, low to the drum or if I'm just getting this big full sound, those particular sets are my go-to, mainly because when I bought them, they weren't exactly perfect for what I wanted to achieve sound-wise, so I took them apart and rebuilt them with my own materials, my own felt, my own liners, everything like that. And not only was it good just for me and being able to be solid and consistent and stable, but it separated how I sounded from everyone else who especially was auditioning, because you're going to have a lot of people come from specific schools and they're all going to generally sound like one another. The ones who stand out, positive or negative, are going to be the ones that try to create their own identity, their own sound, if you will.
Do you take action to protect your hearing?
I keep earplugs with me when we do our pop shows because a lot of them use amplification. And so the front band or the artist that we're accompanying will sometimes have sound levels that are above what is really good for our ears, just sitting there listening. And then on top of it, you're actually playing. And then when everyone else around you starts playing and it's all coming through monitors and it's all coming through amplification, it can be really tough on the ears. For most classical weeks, I usually don't have to bother with it. This week, I am because right beside me, a large bell for the Strauss is right there off of my high drum. So when that is hit, even if it's hit very close to the bell, it still produces just a tremendous amount of sharp overtones that, long after the rehearsal, I can still hear reading.
really do have to be a historian to be an orchestral musician and to effectively sort of know what you're interpreting. A lot of it is not on the page, especially I think in the percussion section.
No, a lot of it actually over time has become part of a tradition of this is how the music is interpreted. And then you just carry that on to the next work and the next work. But with more American music, especially the new American music, you've got a lot more advanced notation techniques, and what the composer is looking for is much more specified.
What do you want people to know about the instrument? What do you think people should know about the timpani when they see it and hear it?
That it is... Its purpose and its intention in the orchestra is to be foundational. It's there to support what the orchestra is doing at key moments. But more importantly, these days composers are recognizing more and more that the instrument is capable of so much more than just playing 5-1-5-1 over and over and over again.
It's a cliche to hear an instrumentalist say, you know, my instrument is like a living, breathing thing, but it really is in that you have to take care of it like it's a living, breathing thing.
Yes. Not only with just regular maintenance, but checking every time that you come into play that you're able to sound good with everyone else that you're playing with. And that if there are any issues that, you know, you have the spare materials and the resources to take care of any of those little things that you can that do matter. You know, it's the little things that can add up and become big problems later.
It's the great misconception about percussionists that we're just hitting things all the time, that it's a matter of are you going to hit it or not, that it's actually incredibly nuanced, the amount of time we spend on this one particular task.
Well, and then if you're a percussionist, it's not only hitting stuff when you're supposed to, but the selecting the right tone color, the right timbre, the right wood block, if you will, for, you know, the John Adams piece that we're going to be doing on the same program, the right high, the right low, the right middle pitch wood block, you know, what you're going to hit the wood block with. All that stuff makes a difference. The, you know, vast varieties of xylophone mallets that can be used, marimba mallets, cymbals, all of it's important in selecting and creating that atmosphere that not only belongs and sounds well in the hall, sounds well with the orchestra, but it has to fit within the atmosphere of the piece that you're trying to perform.
Keeping Score is a production of Nashville Public Radio and 91 Classical. The show was edited by Nina Cardona and Anita Bug. In this episode, we heard performances of the Nashville Symphony engineered by Trevor Wilkinson, including Also Sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss, Elgar's Enigma Variations, Short Ride on a Fast Machine by John Adams, and Ogum Badagry by Christopher Rouse. Be sure to set up your automatic download by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. Next time, we'll talk to the maestro himself, Giancarlo Guerrero, about Mahler's magnificent Fifth Symphony. I'm Colleen Phelps. Thanks for listening to Keeping Score.